exist. I'm glad you didn't leave yet. Okay, for purposes of the tape ministry, I'm Erling Jorsted. This is a presentation called Being Religious in America, and it's a gorgeous fall day on the 4th of September in 1986. And we have a good-looking crowd here. And this will be quite a bit different from the presentation we had yesterday. So you've heard my best jokes, so I can't do that anymore. And although I have one former student here, did I repeat myself from any of my jokes yesterday? I hope not. That's good. I don't think I have any others here. Okay. And not from 3 years ago with the Regal Butos. I don't think I've repeated any jokes. And so let me put in the commercial as long as we're doing plugs for the Magic Show Saturday at 3. Saturday at 3. I saw the Magic Show 3 years ago, and it's terrific. And after 3 years, you can only improve. So, really, it's a very good show, and I think any of you would enjoy it very much. And it is magic, so to say. Okay. Basically, what I've tried to do in the book is answer this kind of, I hope it's a puzzling kind of title for you, Being Religious in America. Now, people can say right away, well, that being religious is being religious. It doesn't matter if it's in America, if it's in Canada, if it's in Mexico, if it's anywhere else in the world. I had the good fortune about 8 years ago to lead a group of St. Olaf students into Northern Thailand, where we studied for a semester. And that is a long ways away from, Rice County, Minnesota. And there we found people who were, very deeply, profoundly religious. Almost all were Buddhists. And we found, obviously, that you could be just as, quote, religious in a country like Thailand, it was the Far East program, that you could be anywhere else. And that caused me, as well as our students and others, to reflect on this question about, does it make any difference where you are in your, your nationality, your homeland, whatever, home country, whatever you want to call it, does it make any difference, where you are in terms of how you might want to express your religious faith? Does your location make any difference? What about, and that of course raises a larger question, which I'm certainly not going to go into today, is that the question of, what we call the big word for it is universalism. How can we say that, Christianity is the way, when we have, major world religions with far more people in them than we have among Christians, in the Buddhists and the Hindus and the Muslims and so many of the other groups. That raises that particular kind of question. Some people have tried to cope with that question by studying the various world religions as we tried to do and find the common elements that we found. We found, for instance, and I think it's fair to say, and I know you've had some seminary experience and check me on this, but that the golden rule is found in every one of the world major religions. In one way or another, the golden rule is found in these as one indication of what I'm trying to say here by about being religious in a different country. Okay. And so the golden rule isn't simply just the private property of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And we found there are other kinds of similarities. But we also found, I remember the first day we were there, we knew we were in a different world. We got up about 5 in the morning. It was very light and everything else. And we looked out the window in Chiang Mai. This is a city in northern Thailand where we were. And there were about 10 of the monks, shaven heads in the long saffron, or the orange robes, barefoot, going from door to door with their begging bowls, for their food. And that was, as I say, a long ways away from Rice County, Minnesota. So we were, if you want to call that culture shock, whatever, it raised the question of what I want to try to talk about a little bit today. And again, like yesterday, and I thought we had a very good discussion yesterday, very good. We have plenty of, I'll put the clock out here right away so I won't go over time like I almost thought I did yesterday. Raise the question about what do I mean by being religious in America, and does it really make any difference that we happen to live in America? All right. Now, by way of sort of transition into the next point here, then what I would say, obviously, is that one can be religious in the best sense of the word in any country, in any culture, whatever your religion may be, Buddhist or Hindu or Muslim or whatever it might be. Okay. No question about the sincerity of that. But each country obviously has its own, what I would call cultural and political and social kinds of backgrounds and traditions. We have a body of law, we have a constitution in this country, for instance, which is totally different from that, not totally, but much different from that of any other country. We have a pattern, for instance, in this country of migration, of immigrants, which is very different from any other country. All of us, in a very real sense, obviously, are strangers to this country because, obviously, the Native Americans were here first. And hence, we are intruders, obviously, on this particular land, and that has made a difference so far as the American people are concerned. We have those things. Another thing we have that I talked about a little bit yesterday in this country, we have a tradition of religious pluralism. We have, as I mentioned, just in terms of formality, at least 280 different denominations which have registered with the Internal Revenue Service. Not to say that probably dozens and hundreds of others of what we call storefront churches, which simply have never bothered because they don't need to register with the IRS. So we have these kinds of things which make religion, being religious, I should say, in our country a little bit different. We have the thing we call freedom of religion. We have separation of church and state, which is different than any other country, which you don't find. Many of you have been in Europe, and you don't find that at all, the separation of church and state there, where the government pays the expenses of the church and all the kind of nuances that are connected with this. So what I would like to try to do today is suggest something in a way which is the background of what I was talking a little bit about yesterday. How would I, as a person, not just as a historian here, because sometimes historians like to say a lot of things, as I think people said I got a lot of words out yesterday anyway. I don't know if I got a lot of knowledge out or wisdom, but I certainly got a lot of words out. That's why I like to quote my friend, Senator Humphrey. But I'd like to talk today not so much as a historian. We're supposed to be objective and balanced and calm, and truth is somewhere in the middle between this side and that side and all the rest. But rather my own particular statement or belief on the basis of my study and my observations and all the rest of what does it mean in this country, in the best sense of the word, to be religious? What difference does it make in by living in America to be religious as an expression, obviously, of our response to God? That is, in a way, it's sort of a profession, if you want to put it that way. In a way, it's a kind of analysis. In a way, I'm glad to do it here because you don't do these things in the classroom. In the classroom, you stand up very objective and very calm and balanced about all these things. And, you don't really, but there's always a hidden agenda. In any teacher's class, I don't know if you spotted my hidden agenda. But it's fun to see a former student here. That's why I keep looking over in this direction. But they came back anyway. That's the best part of it all. She came after all the putting up with all this stuff. She came back anyway. And Jane Austen is a former. She's here, and she's a former major in American Studies with me. Okay, I guess you get the idea of what I'm trying to get at. And what I've come up with, and I do apologize a little bit here, about reading from a manuscript, because this is the first time through publicly on this particular material, and I don't feel quite ready yet to go at it in a total memorization kind of way, because I always worry sometimes about people who never use notes. Maybe some people are always impressed by speakers who never use notes. And I like to think that maybe notes help to remind the speaker of what she or he is supposed to be saying. And maybe if they don't have notes, they forgot to say something which is pretty important. We have, maybe some of you remember in our school, and I don't say this critically, one of our presidents when I first started there was named Clemens Granskow. And I would sit sometimes, and we used to, at the faculty, very elitist, we'd sit right in the very front. And the students and the peons would have to sit in the back, obviously, and the faculty were supposed to sit in the front. That doesn't happen anymore. But Granskow, so I could watch President Granskow speak, and he'd be going, and he'd get off on a theme for a while, and then all of a sudden he'd flip about six pages of notes, in his little book. And I figured, what in the world, what has he forgotten here that he had written down that he wanted to tell us? So that's my explanation for why I want to use some notes with this sort of thing. Okay. That it's an explanation for this sort of thing. Now, on this, what I've tried to do, and I'm not trying to be cute, you'll see all five words start with the letter P, which makes for good alliteration, and editors like that sort of thing. Editors like nice, catchy, flashy little things that put up things like this. There was a famous one that I modeled this after. There's a marvelous, very important book by H. Richard Niebuhr called Christ and Culture, in which he has Christ against culture, Christ over culture, Christ in culture, Christ through culture. And that's where I got my idea that if you can find something like this, you can use some alliteration with this. But I would like to suggest that from my study and my reflection and some of my participation also in the American political process, such as it was, I've never voted. That's right, since Ike, I've never voted for a president who's won. So that gives me some. That gives you some indication of how well I can pick. About as bad as my picking at the racetrack this summer, so we won't even talk about that one. All right. Now, first of all, by way of introduction here, I like to quote a good friend of mine, Professor Samuel Hill, at University of Florida. He says this, that religious faith cannot be placed in any kind of single pigeonhole. Faith has both an outer history, which I study and others study in American religious history. It has both an outer history and an inner history. An inner history, that is, what does it mean to each of us to be religious? What does it mean to, for each of us to be religious, you know, in our own lives? It is this kind of approach to faith is much like a many-sided diamond. And as his name really, his nickname is Sam Hill. Can you imagine? Who in the Sam Hill? Okay, but that really is his name. He's a good friend, and he's heard that joke so many times that it just sort of passes right off him. It's like a teacher at Carleton. His name really is Perry Mason. And he's, you know, it goes right by him. So anyway, as Samuel Hill says about Christianity, and I quote him here, it should prize search, quest, movement, dialectic, paradox, mystery, irony, and humor, as well as certainty and boldness of conviction and earnestness of spirit. In other words, these are some good definitions, really, or good terms which help explain what being religious is all about. Quest, movement, dialectic, paradox, mystery, irony, and humor, as well as certainty and boldness of conviction and earnestness of spirit. Okay, another, that would be sort of the inner way of understanding what being religious is all about. Another way, obviously, is to face the question directly, do you have to be connected or should you be connected with an organized religious body in order to be religious? Are you sort of separating yourself apart from sources of nourishment and strength and encouragement by, you know, separating yourself from the church? Because the church for many of us supports, it admonishes, it directs, and it nourishes our faith. In large groups, obviously, churches carry out social ministries, which would be beyond the grasp really of any particular single individual or local congregation. Yet it's fair to say, I think, in America, and I'm sure this is true in other countries too, that many people are deeply and devoutly religious without necessarily being connected directly with the church. And that is one of the major questions today, because what's happening is that slowly but clearly more and more, especially younger adults, are not simply joining the churches. And that helps account for some of the drop in membership in many kinds of places. All right. So what I would try to say here is that being religious does involve some of these verbs, or these nouns, I should say, that I learned here are used from Sam on the one hand, but it also doesn't necessarily mean that you have to belong to an organized religious body. Some people may disagree with that, and it's certainly that I personally am not opposed to, you know, the organized church. I have to say right away, my brother was a pastor in the ALC for 35 years, just retired, and my son, some of you were here last week, my son is an ordained pastor in the American Lutheran Church, and so I've got family connections anyway. That gives me a little bit more respectability, I guess, than if I didn't have those kinds of connections. Okay, now what do I mean by these five words that I've got on the board here? Public, political, pluralistic, prophetic, and persuasive. As I say, these all make for good alliteration, but maybe they will help us in trying to clarify some of these things, which I would suggest being religious in America means. I'm not talking about what it would mean to be religious in Mexico or Canada, just to pick our two, you know, closest neighbors, or some of them, because they should be, you know, considered the, you know, closest to us. Okay. First of all, being religious means to acknowledge what I call the public dimension of faith. The public dimension of faith. So that it's not just totally a private kind of matter. Robert Bella and his associates, in his famous book, which we're going to use here in a winter program called Habits of the Heart, Robert Bella says this very well. Can I quote him? We find ourselves not independently of other people and institutions, but through them. We find ourselves not independently of other people and institutions, but through them. We never get to the bottom of ourselves on our own. We discover who we are when we are face to face and side by side with others, learning and loving. That is, being public means running the risk of conflict with other groups, other interests. Some religious people keep their faith to themselves, to avoid such conflict. And I want to talk about the church being sort of a center for conflict a little bit later on. Accepting conflict in public means we have freedom for experiencing conflicting viewpoints, including religious viewpoints. We are bold enough to think that our public expressions of faith is less a doing to others, and it is more a being with others. I like that way of putting it. It's not so much doing to as a matter of being with others. And if any of you ever heard John Tram, who was the director here for 6 years, you know, this is one of John's strongest themes that he develops all the way through his many tapes. And I would certainly encourage some people, any of you here, to listen to John's many splendid insights on this. Okay, in this day of high-powered public relations techniques, we need to make one qualification here about being public. being, when I say when religion means being public, it does not mean being publicity-minded. We can find in certain of Jesus' teachings, for instance, a priority for keeping information about his ministry within his own circle of followers, of keeping a prayer, for instance, away from the street corners, of not doing acts of righteousness before others, of keeping the right hand from knowing what the left hand is doing. There's a kind of a theme there that you can find. Obviously, he was talking about the Pharisees here, about their public demonstration of faith. And when I say going public, I don't mean in the sense of it being publicity-minded with this. I think that's it's an interesting insight. Being religious in public means a recognition not of the need for publicity, but of dependence on the goodness that comes from interaction with others who also need help and offer help for us. Okay, that's the first point of what I mean by being religious. It means being public. There is the inner side, the inner nurturing, which is very important, but it means being public. Okay, the plot thickens here. Let's go to the second one. Being religious also means being political. And a lot of people right away, rise up, what do you mean by being political? Should we have politics, partisan politics, in the churches? And I'll talk about that quite a bit. I talk quite about that quite a bit in the book and about the one I talked about yesterday. And also I'll talk about that on Saturday some, but I don't mean political here in the sense of partisan campaigning. Okay, this is what I'm getting at. We have a wide variety of meanings, for the word politics. It can mean a lot of different things. I think all of us know what we mean by office politics or faculty politics or school politics or church politics. We just saw, and Elmer talked about some church politics that were going on about 6%, 9%, and 12%. That was for pensions, that was a political decision for the pensions discovery in Milwaukee versus Chicago. As a site for the ALC, as a political kind of decision. I'm not talking about that kind of politics. In this book, that's what I'm talking about here. In this book, politics means the process. Politics means the process by which we decide public policy. We see that our officials respond to that policy, and we hold them accountable for that policy. In other words, what I'm getting at in policy is, by the use of the word politics here, is how do we determine what our public policy should be? Classic example right now is going on in Congress would be the reform of the tax code. This is a major, major sort of thing that's going to affect all of us. Brian is already, cranking up for major changes because he's a consultant with taxes and financial planning. And you're going to have to do a lot of homework before April 15th.
Already have.
You already have started. Good. We've been talking about this. And I told him that I heard that the Republican bill in my tax bracket would give me $387 more than I had last year. So I went out and spent it right away. So I decided that I don't know if I'm going to vote Republican because of that, but at least I went. No, I didn't spend it. But anyway, you get the idea here everybody in the Democrats said we're going to give you, if you get 387, we're going to give you 412 or something else like that. So anything you can do, I can do better. Okay. Politics means the process by which we decide public policy. We see that our elected officials respond to that policy, and then we try to hold them accountable. Either we reelect them or we chase the rascals out or vote the rascals out. That's what I mean by politics here, not office or church politics or school politics or something else like that. Now, the common good of all is served by working within the defined area for serving that good. That means that we get involved in politics. With our religious interests, obviously we are especially alert to politics as it relates to matters of justice, social welfare, law enforcement, and law protection issues, all kinds of things in which the church is directly affected. We're going to talk tonight, isn't it, about who pulls the plug? That's euthanasia. Obviously, that's a very lively political issue in the broadest sense of the word. And I think all of us would recognize right away. Social welfare laws, law enforcement things. My son, for instance, Eric, very active in Michigan in trying to stop the Michigan State Legislature from reinstating capital punishment. And he's learned to work within the political system to do that. You may or not agree with that particular position, but the way you get your position known and where you get your clout, obviously, is to get involved in the political process. And you you lean on the people who vote one way or the other on an issue, obviously a very important moral issue, like capital punishment, or you can name your own agenda here. But you see what I mean by being religious means being political. Because so many of our great decisions, our great issues in life, are settled by people who we send to St. Paul or Tacoma? No, where is it? Olympia, that's a state capital out here. Or Helena or any of the other nearby state capitals with us. Okay, or you can put this another way. We really can't help being political. to avoid all political activity is to really cast a vote for saying, we think social justice issues are not a part of our religious life. Not to take a stand, obviously, is to take a stand. I remember when I had a famous philosopher, a philosophy teacher, my first year in college, and he convinced me that nothing is something. And I thought, I was just dazzled by this. I'd never heard anything like that back in Kenyon, Minnesota. And some of you know it's Howard Hong, and some of you know Edna. And Edna's written many books, and they're old Holden fans here. And I remember Howard explaining to us that nothing is something. Boy, that wow, that really lit up things. I wrote that back to my parents and let them know that I was getting my money's worth. And if any of you have that, let me put in some more plugs for some dear friends and good Holden people, because Howard and Edna were here supporting and working with the village way back in the early 60s, and they're still going very strong. And some of you may have heard Edna talk, and she's, you know, just, they have their office right up floor above me, and it's just a joy to, except when Howard comes in with his two for a nickel cigars, and El Ropo or something is what he smokes, I think, but anyway. It was pretty bad. Now, all right, now, being against politics is to say that you're giving in to the status quo. And obviously, that's a political statement. If you don't get involved in politics, what you're simply doing is saying, we endorse those people who are in politics right now, and that is a political statement in itself. Okay, now the problem, obviously, here is that we have to always avoid trying to identify our particular political interests with the will of God. Let me quote here one of my favorite American theologians, Reinhold Niebuhr. And Niebuhr never tired of reminding us that we are, to use his sort of big academic words here, that we are finite and contingent creatures, tending to endow the contingent values of our lives and culture, of our truths and loyalties, with an absolute significance they did not deserve. By that he means probably God isn't a capitalist. I think that's fair to say, although one of my good friends, at least I study him a lot, Jerry Falwell, finds capitalism in the Old Testament, which I find an amazing insight. I don't know why I haven't reached that insight, that capitalism is in the Old Testament. I'll save Jerry Falwell for Saturday. Okay. Or God may not be a Democrat or a Republican, or maybe not even, you know, given Holden, you may not even be a vegetarian. I love Elmer's remark today, you remember, at noon about that. Okay. Now, to get back on a serious thing, only God is the source of absolutes, you know, not the Republican Party or the Socialist Party or any of the others which go along with this, on this sort of thing. Okay, but if we get into politics, right away people can say, if we get into politics, aren't we running the risk of becoming controversial? Aren't we running the risk of having arguments with some of our friends, coming into conflict with friends or colleagues? Should religious faith, you know, go out of its way in a very real sense to sort of invite conflict, to invite divisiveness? Why should that have to happen, you know, in church? And here I'll quote a couple of people. Here it happens to be Charles Letts, I'm quoting, and he's the director of the Office of Church and Society in the ALC. And he said something I think very well here. The gospel is God's declaration. Our political behavior is part of our response to God's activity. The gospel is good news from God. Our social witness involves good advice from the people of God in seeking the public good along with many others. The gospel motivates us. It does not provide us with a blueprint for ordering society. And that therefore, when we have that particular perspective, obviously, we have some sort of distance and judgment on what really is the will of God and what isn't. But nevertheless, if we want major decisions to be made according to our particular moral and religious convictions, obviously one of the surest ways for doing this is to get involved directly in politics, which is not the case in many other countries. I used Thailand because it's such an obvious total difference. In there, there's just no way even a devout Buddhist could have any influence on the government. Frankly, the government is so corrupt that's another story. And militaristic that it wouldn't listen to the Buddhists at that particular time. Okay, to move on here, the third point is that being religious means pluralistic. Now that ingredient, or the word pluralistic, means that as Americans we respect the great tradition of religious pluralism or religious freedom. Now that is something we always like to say and makes us all feel good and everything else, but really being sympathetic towards all religious bodies isn't quite as easy as it sounds. It involves, first of all, showing respect for the religious traditions and expressions of other people. and a certain willingness to celebrate those kinds of differences. Do we really want to do that, to show real respect for those with which with whom we disagree and to celebrate those differences? In our day, I think, because I think Americans are becoming more fragmented and more in conflict with one another, such celebration or respect for the rights of others and the expressions of others, I think, seems to be declining. For instance, give you just one issue that we could talk about, the battles, and we talked about this a little bit yesterday, the battles that are going on over the expression of religion in public schools. As an example of people not being willing to compromise and being insistent that they keep religion out of public schools as a way of protecting what they think to be a religious pluralism on this. All right. Now, secondly here, I think that's one point. Being pluralistic means accepting the fact that our society need not be Christianized to serve the needs of others. There are those who still hope that in one way or another that we are going to have some sort of, you know, Judeo-Christian or probably just a Christian kind of society. The idea being of having a, you know, what we like to call a Christian America. I like what Professor Paul Sonic of the seminary says, the church is not meant to compete with society or offer itself as a substitute for it. The church is not to act as a substitute for society or to compete with society. And John Schramm talks about that very strongly on this. The church and believers are to cooperate with society in its power to the extent that love and law serve the same end. That is the good of the neighbor. In other words, what he's talking about here is what we call Caesar's question. What is Caesar's, you know, and what is God's? And that is a very legitimate kind of question, and one which obviously there is not going to be any clear final for answer for this. Okay. Third, being pluralistic means accepting both compromise and conflict as healthy in our public lives. Compromise comes hard for a people of faith who believe they have some insight into that which is, you know, eternal and transcendent. But so too do others. I'm talking about, you know, arguing with people of different denominations. Nowhere is that more evident today or more irritating to many than in the new controversy over what I talked about a little bit yesterday, that is the new Christian right. From that source, the loyalty we have for pluralism is being tested because the new Christian right seems bent on having its way without compromise towards, you know, the larger public. What hopefully will emerge from the dialogue between the new Christian right and others, I think, is a recognition that our faith is better served when it is open and when, if necessary, divisive conflict is accepted to be normal and welcome for the public concerns of the churches. But how many people don't want, you know, let's take a good example of adult forums, how many people don't want lively discussion in adult forums? If you have, you know, the traditional way of 8:30 service and then 9:45 adult forum, then your second service at 11, which is pretty standard, I guess, in most, you know, many Protestant churches, how many people really look forward to a good lively debate over, you know, certain issues in that? Somehow church should be where, you know, you're nice and pleasant and smile and upbeat and all the rest of these things. I always remember, if I quoted Dr. Granskow before, I'll quote him again. He had a wonderful statement towards the end of the school year. He said, he was talking to the students, he said, if you came here thinking you would meet nice people and that you would have a nice time and that you would study nice issues and you'd go away feeling nice, he said, we failed you completely. And I've always liked that as a good insight on this sort of thing. Okay. Being religious, fourth of all, means being prophetic. And again, we have to be careful here about definition of words. The word, the prophetic here, does not mean, you know, like Jeannie Dixon or something else, the ability to foretell the future. A long time ago, she predicted that Kennedy was going to lose in 1960, and so I sort of gave up on her after that, but some other things. It is not, you know, foretelling the future. The word prophetic means something else. It means being willing to bring to the public life a sense of right and wrong, of evaluation and judgment on the quality of that public life. The word here is used as being allied to the prophetic traditions of the Old Testament. Few of us today, however, would cry, you know, woe unto you, America, for you have sinned. I mean, how many people, where do you hear that today? Anywhere. Woe unto, you know, just, or something like that. Very rarely do you hear this sort of thing, because now, obviously, the accent is always on the upbeat and the pleasant and more the Norman Vincent Peale, you know, kind or of upbeat, or Robert Schuller, if you like. I'll talk about Schuller on Saturday. That might get a few people here if I say something critical of Schuller now, because a lot of people like Schuller. Okay. Few of us would cry, woe unto you, America. When we detect wrongdoing, we say that everybody else is doing it, or that we don't have enough information to make judgments on this, or that we should be sensitive to the needs of others, rather than talking about this. For instance, in all the Protestant churches today, and I think this may be true in many Catholic churches, you never hear the theme or the topic of hell being published or being preached anymore. I would ask you, when's the last time you heard a rousing sermon on hell or eternal damnation being preached? Now it's just, you know, pushed away, and And maybe, you know, maybe some of those famous sermons like Jonathan Edwards' Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God should not be preached any longer, because people who were sinners were being dangled over, you know, pits of fiery coals with spiders, and I get choked up even thinking about it. But it's the idea that there isn't much talk really about judgment. You don't have to talk about hell as such. And some people might wonder about that. Let me just put in parenthetically here. The word hell came out of the Judeo tradition when they were trying to think of the worst possible place anywhere. They decided that the worst possible place was the public dump outside of Jerusalem. And because of the smells, and we didn't have the sanitary landfill, you know, in those days, as we have with the big trucks and everything today, and having your garbage out by Thursday at 8 or anything else like that. We had these terrible places, and the worst possible place was the Jerusalem dump, and the word for that was hell. The Hebrew word for dump, public dump, was hell, so that's how that got started with this. Okay. Now, the idea here of the church being prophetic is what I'm trying to say as a part of being religious, you know, in America, because the church, I think that what I'm trying to say is the church should get directly involved in, you know, in a variety of issues. Not taking a stand politically, they would lose their income tax status if they did that, but getting involved with this sort of thing. Okay, I have a couple examples but of what I'm getting at, but I'll skip those if you're wondering why I'm turning two or three pages at one time here after I said that. It could be important, that's right, Brian. You can read it with a second. And finally, being religious means being persuasive. Persuasive here. That means using moral suasion rather than coercion to carry the faith into public life. What I'm trying to say, it's to be religious means to be persuasive rather than coercive. Because if you have to coerce somebody into being religious, that person isn't religious at all. Let me give you a classic example from the founder, or the name at least, of the person who was the namesake, I should say, from my own college, St. Olaf College in Northfield. And St. Olaf, like Gustavus Adolphus, I'll throw that in right away, brought Christianity to the homeland by the way of the sword, rather than by way of persuasion. And the leader of the pagan forces, this is one of my favorite stories, the leader of the pagan forces in Norway is supposed to have been known as Erling the Leathernik. I always love that. one of my ancestors was Erling the Leathernik, the pagan. And does my heart good sometimes when I think of the way in which Gustavus Adolphus and St. Olaf tried to spread the word. And we had people like Erik the Blood Axe as sort of the missionary wing of the Norwegian Lutheran Church, and other cheerful ideas like that. But the story is, and it's totally apocryphal, but it's a good story, that like always in the great epic battles, the leaders of the two forces finally have the final showdown, you know, like high noon, and they have to square off, and this is it. And Erling the Leathernik met St. Olaf, you know, after everybody else had gone and died into the smoke belching up like a Wagner opera and all these things. And then St. Olaf is supposed to have gotten Erling prone, and he said, "Accept Christianity or I'll cut your head off." And Erling the Leathernik is supposed to have said in return, "Cut away," as an example of his kind. That kind of warms my heart that somebody did that. Okay. Now, being persuasive rather than being coercive. Okay, John Garvey here, I'll quote, helps us remember why. Over the centuries, religious leaders have become, as he calls it, too cozy with the political powers that be, a situation which creates abuse within the churches. The specific identification, for instance, of a nation's foreign policy with the will of God, we talked about that yesterday with Manifest Destiny, remember? With the will of God, and the church's endorsement of that policy would be a good example of such coziness. Some will remember the famous story when it was 1898, when President William McKinley had to decide whether or not the United States should invade the Philippine Islands. You know how dangerous a threat to American security the Philippine Islands were to us at that particular time. And he said, and I'm sure he was totally sincere, that he spent the whole night on his knees praying as to whether or not the United States should take the Philippine Islands. And he finally said we should do it on the basis of the fact that we could now Christianize the Philippine Islands. The only trouble was the Roman Catholics had been there for three centuries, which makes gives some indication about what William McKinley had in mind in terms of imperialism and some of the other things. Okay, yeah, that's just the example I use here. Okay. Garvey makes this point. A truth which is enforced is not really a truth. A child who parrots the right answers in school without understanding has learned nothing. Religion at the social level has been that way too often. It betrays its nature and its deepest helpfulness when it is token of belonging to the crowd of good citizens and respectable citizens. It may indeed have served well as a social control in certain points in the past, but that is not what the prophets or the gospel are all about. They call us to an entirely different, if you like, radical lifestyle rather than simply identifying with the powers that be. Nowhere did Jesus attempt to coerce a person into discipleship. No coercion at all on that sort of thing. His was the power of example, of persuasiveness, of appealing to the best of a person's character, of demonstrating the joys of a life of faith. But then, of course, the question becomes, can that be done? But it not be true that ours is an age when power decides which is to be done rather than persuasion? Persuasiveness, that is something probably some people say that is left to people of less combative temperaments. Okay. Perhaps that's true. Perhaps this is a world of what the Germans used to call realpolitik, or power politics, Bismarck's famous dictum of power, you know, politics is the art of the possible. What you can get done is what's right, and so on. Perhaps that's true. But some concrete ways of being persuasive rather than coercive can tell us what the prophets and the gospels are all about. Believers can become advocates for public policies consistent with the social witness of our biblical faith. In 1982, the American Lutheran Church outlined such a plan in its call for advocacy. And this is the one I talked a little bit about Larry Rasmussen yesterday, and this is one of Larry's ideas. This was group being an advocate, group or individual activity seeking to influence societal power centers or processes of decision-making towards both justice for those who are relatively voiceless or powerless and the well-being of the whole human family on the basis of an understanding of the biblical vision of community health and wholeness. Advocacy is not the same thing as lobbying, which consists of, you know, the pursuit of self-interest. Advocacy is pleading the cause of others or of the whole human family. It is directed at, quote, centers of power, usually economic or political power, but also at the church itself, an institution with considerable power. This may be done by several means: ongoing nurture in the faith, in its connections with our societal life, regular preaching of the word in relation to the needs of the world, promoting social and political dialogue among Christians with various viewpoints, and collective advocacy of a major issue when a consensus of a group of Christians is reached. Now, I've got another long sort of stirring, noble, what I call a noble ending to all this, but I'll save the noble ending and because I'd much rather have your comments and responses to this. I realize sometimes people don't respond to what is more of a sermon than a lecture, but I hope I've thrown out enough ideas here on these five P's that may you know, arouse some of your comments and questions. If not, you'll get the stirring noble ending. You know, Marty always says, I told you that one yesterday, didn't I? Can't use that joke again. Okay. Does this make any sense at all? I read it pretty fast, but does this, you know, as I said, this is the first group I've tried this on. And one thing that was true for this book, and I'd like the dust jacket back somewhere, and there it is, good. That is true for that book, and the one that I was talking about yesterday, is that about three of the chapters in there were field tested first here at Holden. And I tried out some of the ideas in 1984 and got, you know, a good response from them. And that helped me in, you know, leading me into where I could understand what people were interested in and what kind of questions they were asking. And I'm always, it's a very selfish motive, I mean, for me being here, other than the wonderful weather and not having freshman term papers to read and no telephones and some of the other things, is I really would like to get your input, because that will show up, I'm sure, in one way or another in the next book that I'm working on now. Yeah.
When you talk about the church, which you did in a number of places, you called it the church.
Yeah.
The church.
Yeah.
What do you mean by the church?
Yeah.
The organization, mm-hmm. or do you mean the body of Christians? Or
yeah. What I'm talking here about would be the organized church, the organized denominations, as a visible, you know, legal, constitutional, whatever term, you know, you want to use, organization or institution, which works, you know, in society itself. There is also the, Luther called it the priesthood of all believers, which would also be the church triumphant, the church universal, whatever term you want to use there. But I'm talking here about specific, you know, groups who organize and have offices in state capitals and have offices in Washington and all the rest to get involved with the issues that I've talked about here, the social justice issues, especially.
Well, no, I'd like to ask, sure. How do you, the church, the organized church, has a number of responsibilities.
Right.
for instance, teaching the word.
Right.
Evangelizing.
Right.
All these things, and you are calling for a high priority here on the church.
Right.
To be political.
Right.
How do you set that priority with the others?
Yeah, some people say the church has to be just one thing, and there used to be the idea that, you know, preach the word, what is it, early to bed, early to rise, preach the gospel and evangelize, was a slogan from the 1920s. Not a very good one, but it makes the point. And the church ministers to the whole person. I know that's sort of a cliche, the holistic kind of thing, but it's true. And none of us are just one thing. None of us are just spiritual beings. None of us are ethereal souls that sort of float around up there somewhere. All of us have, you know, flesh and blood, and we have bodily needs as well as we have spiritual needs. And that one thing that the church tries to do, and it can never do perfectly, is to minister to all the different, you know, human needs. I mean, the school talks about one has one need, the government has one, business has one, the military, whatever, you know, they minister or are involved in only one of our specific needs in life. But the church tries to say we're involved with everything from A to Z, with grieving processes and with teaching children and with administering the sacraments and upholding morality in the local communities and the whole variety of things that the church has with this foreign, you know, you all know the list, okay? And so I would say then I'm only pleading obviously for one part of this sort of thing. One thing that the church can do to carry out what I would consider to be its mission, its mandate, if you like, is to get involved in public kinds of issues. Because there are things which are Caesar's, and there are things which are God's. And I think that would be the text that I would use for this. And it's true, some churches, and there's no question about this, have gone totally overboard and have become nothing much more really than political lobbies. We had in Minneapolis this summer, the Presbyterian Church had its national convention in the Twin Cities. It's a nice city with all the lakes and everything to have conventions in. And the one Presbyterian conservative got up and said that, why is it that the social issues agenda of the Presbyterian Church sound like the, you know, the platform of the Democratic Party? And he made a pretty good point. And that's where the danger lies. You know, the question of this whole thing about what we call the social gospel. Too much emphasis on the social and not enough on the gospel, or too much on the gospel and not enough on the social. What I'm asking for is a recognition that this is an important priority, and that this is one way of ministering to all the different kinds of needs which people face. Does that?
But how do we do it? That's the question. And should it be in having forum type things so that people become aware and so that they want to go and I think that if the pastor says, well, this is what's Christian, isn't, then it's no good.
No.
And I
would say, though, that not to be afraid of conflict in the churches and having discussion. I suppose some people will say there's enough conflict anyway. You don't like the minister, you don't like the organist. You know, why should we have to raise his salary, or, you know, that those kinds of conflicts that are on board things. Why bring in politics or something else like that is another way of dividing people. But my own feeling would be that on the basis of what I call being persuasive here, it's the educational function of the church would be well served by bringing out what some of the ramifications or the implications are of these issues. Civil rights would have been a very good one, for instance. Or one that's been debated here, for instance, at Holden, and which is going to, I think, increase rather than decrease, the whole question about ministry to homosexuals is a very important one, which, you know, some people don't want to talk about because it's, you know, kind of embarrassing for some, but obviously there are many homosexuals who are asking for some kind of response from the churches, and many who are very seriously, you know, devout in their faith. And a lot of people don't like that because of, you know, for the obvious reason. And I would say that the best thing that the church can do is, you know, encourage people to talk about the issues, bring out the, you know, the different sides, present information, educational materials, which help elucidate these sort of things. I don't like what was done in 1984, I didn't talk about this, but many churches, and it was totally legal, became centers for voter registration. You could go down, you didn't have to go to the county courthouse or city hall or whatever it was. You could vote, you could register for voting right in your own local church. Did any of you have that in your parishes? That was mostly the Falwell Robertson group that did this. As I say, it's legal, and a lot of black congregations did this with Jesse Jackson. So I try to be bipartisan, you see, when I say that. But that, I think, is, you know, probably could lead to some difficulties, because people would say, well, this is a conservative church, I registered here, so that means the church really wants me to vote conservatively. And I think there's where the danger is. But does that help on what you're trying to say?
Well, yeah, I just...
And it's a very tricky thing, because some people...
I have some opinions that would differ from other opinions, I mean, whether or not I'm pro-choice or whatever.
That's the ultimate one. Let me give you a very good example. The ALC in 1984, in their international convention, asked the Office of Church and Society, Chuck Lutz's office, to have a study prepared on the implications of the 1984 campaign so far as church-state relations and religion and politics were concerned in the country. They wanted a study which would serve as a policy paper or as a position paper for the ALC. Well, I know Chuck, and Chuck asked me to do it for the ALC. And this was mandated by the convention, which is the highest authority in the ALC. All right, Lutz's committee is called, you know, the Committee on Church and Society meets every year, and there are 40 people in it. And I presented the paper. I've got a copy here. I'll be cheerfully, distribute it if anybody wants to read it, because it never got to be position paper for the ALC for the reason that I want to talk about here, is that there was not because it, I thought it was a good paper. That wasn't the reason it was turned down, but there were some people who said we should not even talk about politics, in a church setting. They were three of the 40 were willing to go against the specific and explicit directions of the convention. They said, we are going to simply disobey what the convention told us to do. And we're going to vote and saying the jurisprudence paper shouldn't even be put on Chuck Lutz's table up at 426 South Fifth. And that's a total, what I call a know-nothing position. I mean, you're just putting your head into the sand pile with that sort of thing. And that's where it gets to be very tricky.
Don't you find that many times your congregations say, preach the word, stay out of politics?
Yes.
And this is their basic philosophy, I think, in the majority of congregations.
Yeah, I think that's true, because when they think of politicians, they think of some corrupt person who's got the hand in the cookie jar, or some of the shenanigans with some of the politicians in Washington or in Olympia or St. Paul or something else like that. Or they think of wheeler-dealer kinds of deals made. And there is a stereotype about politicians, which is true for some people, but not for a lot of others. Some of here, I see you, Brian. I can tease him. Okay. Some of he's been an active participant here at Holden Village, and he was our congressman for 21 years, Al Quie. And nobody says these things about Al because he was squeaky clean. And I'm sure you could find that true with a lot of other politicians also. Paul Simon, another one that comes to mind right away, who's been at Holden. I'm just trying to think of politicians who have been here on that sort of thing. And I think a lot of people are afraid that that's what's going to happen when you start talking about the church and politics. And what I'm asking for is the church as an educational agency and enterprise, so that you can put forward to the people, like capital punishment, what's going on. Let me give you an example. I have to brag about my son here. He wrote the position paper for the ALC on capital punishment. And there was a referendum, was it 2 years ago in the state of Oregon? The people were going to decide whether or not to reinstate capital punishment, I think it was. And what the ALC and the LCA did together was to ask Eric, who had done the work from the Lutheran position, plus a civil liberties union a specialist on capital punishment, to come out and speak to different forums of Lutheran ministers throughout Oregon, stating what the position of the Lutheran Church and a traditional civil liberties position would be on this. And not telling them what, the pastors, what to do, but providing this kind of information. And that's exactly what I'm suggesting here. Provide this kind of information on issues like this, because these are very complicated issues. Tonight you're going to hear how complicated euthanasia is, and that it's not a simple, yes or no kind of thing. And that's where the trouble resides, because a lot of people don't vote on the basis of issues, but they vote on the basis of he's a nice guy, or they like, something else like that. And I think I agree with you completely, and I know this is an uphill battle of what I'm talking about here, but there have been enough violations where politicians have used and utilized, ministers. Give you a perfect example. You've never, ever since Watergate, Billy Graham has never gone back to the White House. You remember he was there with Truman, you go right down the line with Ike and Kennedy and all of them, LBJ and all the rest, and he was so burned because he realized he had been used, and exploited by Nixon. That he stayed out, and even though Jimmy Carter was a fellow Southern Baptist and all the rest, he stayed out because that's where it can go the other way. Yeah, sure.
I'm troubled and confused about being religious as, to be in a pluralistic society. What position does a Christian take with a pluralistic society such as we have with Islam and Native American Indian and all the other rich heritages that these people have and cannot be denied or not respected? What is the position of a Christian when we're told to go out and
evangelize? Well, if, let's see, it's 10 to 5, if, you know, it would take a long time, obviously, and I'm sure, but it's a difficult one, because if we believe our conviction, shouldn't we try to, you know, bring others into that kind of position? What's happened in America, and that this has to have some historical background, is that when the Constitution was written and when James Madison drew up the First Amendment, he was so aware of all the religious warfare that had taken place in Europe, and the Inquisitions and all the terrible things that had happened, the 30 Years' War, where by the time they were done, all that had happened was that nobody had changed their religion. There was about, I don't know how many thousand people were dead, and that's the only thing that had happened. And that isn't exactly advancing the kingdom. That Madison wrote into the First Amendment the, you know, no establishment and then the free exercise clauses with this. With Madison's idea, and some people disagree with this, but it's certainly the position of our founding fathers, that there should be a healthy, what he called, competition. What was it, his famous statement? If there were only one religion in this country, there would be total tyranny. If there were only two religions in this country, they would be at each other's throats all the time and not doing what religion is supposed to do. But now that we have many religions, they all learn that if they want to have religious freedom for themselves, they have to allow religious freedom for everybody else. That's what the Puritans learned in New England. If they wanted to have everybody, you know, line up, you know, just the way they wanted to, but then what they found was when the Quakers came and the Catholics and the Jews and the others came, that the only way they could have it for themselves was to allow the Quakers and the Catholics and the Jews to have it for themselves. And one way they could do that in this country and could get by with it was that if you didn't like it where you were, you could move. We can't do that anymore. There's no longer a frontier. There's open land. But you could do that. And that's why the Pennsylvania Quakers went out there. There was nobody else out there. Or all the different groups, the Amish and the, you know, the Bruderhof and the Mennonites and all the rest. They had that opportunity to move away and establish themselves. And then what we decided with our Constitution was that this is what we wanted. And that, therefore, we are free to evangelize, but we're not free to use public power, you know, to try to evangelize or change anybody. I think that's sometimes called the voluntary, I would call that persuasion, sometimes called the voluntary principle. Because this is the amazing thing about America, and one reason I'm so fascinated by the subject, we were the first country to separate church and state. No other, when I'm talking about Western countries, England, France, Norway, none of them had separation of church and state. We did so on the basis of historical necessity. And since that's worked so well, there have been terrible violations, obviously, persecution of Catholics and Jews and so on. But since that's worked, that's where we stand now, and we think it's wrong to use public power to coerce anybody. And that, of course, gets into all kinds of questions about should you require Amish children to go to public schools and all that sort of thing. But that's kind of a Hubert Humphrey answer. You know, it took that long as only Hubert could do to your question. Yeah, Deanne.
In response to that, I would say, as a Christian, we should respect the other religions. And I'm coming from the place of somebody who was not raised Christian, okay?
Yeah.
And I know that the people in my life who had the attitude that somehow they had they had to make everybody be Christian actually drove me away from the church. I think I probably would have become Christian 4 years earlier than I did, because people were being forceful as opposed to persuasive. And I think we have to deal with people on an individual basis. And I'm glad we live in a country where we have the freedom to do that.
What's happened now in foreign missions is that we work with what we call the indigenous population and have seminaries and training for people in, say, Africa. My father, well, Becky, my daughter-in-law's father, is a missionary for the UCC in Africa. And they work exclusively with Native Africans rather than sending over graduates of Yale Divinity School, all white and Anglo-Saxon and all the rest, to do this. And that's giving the people of, in his case, Zimbabwe, the opportunity to decide for themselves. what happened in Thailand, they've been trying, especially the Presbyterians have been trying for 50 years, and they've got less than, what is it, 0.04 of the total population in 40 years has been converted, which is, you know, pretty uphill. So that would be my response there, and it's, and nobody really wants to change the separation of church and state in this country. And nobody, you know, it's why churches have tax exemption. That's a good example to this point. Because if you allowed a government to tax a denomination, it could tax it right out of existence. Remember, Justice Marshall, the power to tax is the power to destroy. Maybe we don't like Jehovah's Witnesses because the kids didn't salute the flag. We talked about that last time. Put a tax on, you know, in other countries you could put a tax on Jehovah's Witnesses. And off, you know, away they would go. And so that's why we get into that whole very sticky issue of tax exemption, but that's why we do it. Not because the churches are poor or couldn't afford it or anything else like that, but because once you start tax, then of course the government has to be very, I mean the courts have to be very flexible on what constitutes a church. And there have been frauds and shenanigans and diploma mills where you could buy, you know, a Bachelor of Divinity degree and somebody declares himself to be a church and therefore claims tax exemption and he doesn't have any, this was a celebrated case in Minnesota, he doesn't have any, you know, church or constituency at all, but he used it simply as a fraud, and so the Minnesota justices worked out a very careful definition of what constitutes a church, and you can't get by with that thing. That's one thing I know the Infernal Revenue Service and all that, but the one thing that I have confidence in the Infernal Revenue Service is that they are very tough and very careful in watching a wide variety of people. They went after Shuler, remember 2 years ago? Mm-hmm. I mean, they aren't just after some four-fleshers who are always ripping off the church. They went after one of the most respectable preachers, you know, in the country because of some tax questions.
It wasn't the IRS, it was the state.
The state, okay, the state. The
Board of Equalization, okay. What was happening was that under the IRS laws, it's all right for a church to rent out its facilities for another organization. But what was happening is Shuler was directly promoting schools and activities, and he wasn't having it rent out by a third party.
Okay.
He was doing it himself, and okay. So they got him for real estate taxes.
Okay. So that's the government is aware of these things, and of course some of you are, I'm sure, are pastors, and you know sometimes the IRS does harass.
Not sometimes,
all the time. Okay.
A lot of times.
In fact, they had to pass a law that finally got through that the IRS couldn't carry on a case against any denomination for more than 2 years. Because sometimes the IRS would want your books, and the bookkeeper or whoever it was would be liable to have to be responsible to go down to IRS offices anytime. This might drag on for years, and it got to be simple harassment. So I don't know if that has to do with my 5 points here, but yes.
One last thing is that on the persuasive side, I think as long as the churches are presenting both sides of the story in a public forum and they're in the church itself or the pastor is not taking a stance, I don't see the problem. But I think a lot of people feel, well, if churches get involved in politics and take a political stance, then this is going to divide the church even more.
It's very tricky because the church obviously is to talk about great moral issues, and something like civil rights, I think, and equality for minorities of all kinds, of gender and class and race and all these things. But sometimes these get down to specific bills. And what do you do then when this gets in the form of a specific kind of bill? That becomes a very tricky kind of thing. I recognize the dangers with this. It's 5 o'clock, and if anybody wants to leave, don't feel guilty or that I won't be upset or anything else. Glad you could come. But I'll be glad to have a break right here.
Well, it's no big deal. There are just a couple of dilemmas that I personally feel. One of them is that I somehow have this feeling that if I elect someone that I feel has, a moral code similar to mine or something, then they will, represent me in some way. And I've been disappointed a few times, like with El Cui,
okay.
And who I think is a great guy, but somehow he wasn't effective, although he was stuck in a depression, which was not of his making. And Jimmy Carter, who I think is was certainly a kind and just and but he just didn't seem to be able to govern, and I feel I feel very frustrated about that. But then that's one thing. The other thing is on things like we have in the past, even though we're a pluralistic society, have had things in individual states, like some of the New England states where the Catholic Church was very strong and there was, contraception was not allowed, and, you know, no, you couldn't even buy the stuff. Abortion was prohibited longer than, you know, than normal. And that being on one, that one issue that, that certainly was colored by the church being in politics in those areas. The, another, I lived always in Minnesota until I moved to Florida. And the whole business of prayer in school, and this suddenly became a big thing. And I was living in prayer in school, I never heard of it, you know. I lived in a town with one church. We never prayed in school. Never even occurred to me that that was something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of things have been
What you're saying is that there has been a very strong increase in conflict over religious issues in public.
Yeah.
No question about that in the last 10, 15 years. And that many of these things never came up. In the 19th century, there was only one major church-state case before the Supreme Court at all, just one major one, and that was polygamy, you know, for the Mormons. And it wasn't until 1940 or so that church-state issues started to multiply in front of the Supreme Court. And now there are major cases. All kinds of cases. The one you have is a celebrated one in Washington. The blind fellow who went to a Bible school, you remember this one? What was it? Blind people are entitled to a certain public compensation, and that he wanted to go to a Bible school for his education. And there were those who said that you shouldn't get public money to go to a Bible school. That was, you know, that's an interesting kind of case. Or the Jewish rabbi who wanted to wear his prayer yarmulke when he was, you know, doing his thing at you know, the various things. And the Supreme Court said, no, he couldn't. I mean, those kinds of things are increasing. Or the one we talked about last time, you know, manger scenes on public property. Oh, all kinds of ones. Oh, fascinating one in Nebraska. I mean, I've got, if you want to sit and listen to it. But a woman said it was wrong and against her religion to have her picture on her driver's license because thou shalt have no graven images before me. And to her, it was wrong to have a picture of herself anywhere. And she took it to the Supreme Court. I admire her, and she won. They defended her on that one, yep. And then people will say, well, you know, on the other hand, you need public, what if everybody said they didn't want their picture? You should see my picture. I'm embarrassed by my picture, but, you know.
We all.
But once you start with that, how are you going to draw the line? So those, you know, to come to your point, that's what's happening. In fact, I talk about that in this book, about the increase in the number of serious cases in litigation or in court procedures that are, this is a very lively
issue.
Not
that I don't think it's probably good and healthy.
Yeah.
You know, I think some of the things are good that they've come out,
yeah.
And that there have been areas that have been.
But it-